This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
How do you update old systems without slowing your business down?
It's not about modernization just to modernize.
Or move AI from pilot to production.
It's not the technology that's failing. It's the use case that you pick.
Find out how global leaders are turning enterprise change into real competitive advantage.
Do it in a resilient way with speed and effectiveness.
Follow Resilient Edge, a Business Vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte. Check out our new episodes wherever you get your podcasts.
Das ist Ihre Millionenchance. Jetzt im Lotto-Jackpot. 26 Millionen Euro. 26 Millionen Euro. Lotto Bayern. Nimm dein Glück in die Hand.
Spielteilnahme ab 18. Chance auf den Höchstgewinn 1 zu 140 Millionen. Glücksspiel kann süchtig machen. Hilfe unter bjuk.de.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Israel bombed the Iranians. The Iranians bombed the Israelis. America wanted negotiations, but then also bombed the Iranians. There was a ceasefire. Then there wasn't, leading to this on Tuesday.
We basically have two countries that have been fighting so long and so hard that they don't know what the they're doing. Do you understand that?
Then there was a ceasefire again. Iranian airspace has just reopened. But what next? For the US and Israel, the declared objective has been to destroy Iran's capacity to make a nuclear bomb with a side order of regime change if possible. For Iran, the objective is now, well, what exactly? To bide their time to punish the Americans and Israelis? To rebuild their nuclear weapons program? Or just for the regime to stay in power? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. Donald Trump insists Iran's nuclear program has been set back decades by the US military strikes, despite a leaked intelligence report casting doubt on the extent of that success. But how far had Iran got with its nuclear program? I'm joined by Dr. Patricia Lewis, who's an arms control expert with a background in nuclear physics. Patricia Lewis, quite a few countries have got the nuclear bomb, and we've been hearing for years about Iran getting the nuclear bomb. So why hasn't it got one yet?
Before the 1979 revolution, the Shah had an embryonic program. And when the revolution occurred and the Ayatollahs took over the running of the country, they decided to axe it. They weren't even keen on having nuclear power then for peaceful purposes. They then, of course, later on became quite interested in having nuclear power for peaceful purposes. Then there was the Iran-Iraq war, which was a major issue for them because Iraq used chemical weapons on Iranian people, on Iranian Kurds, and on troops. Iran developed chemical weapons, but made the decision not to use them because they were against God. And they have this fatwa against weapons of mass destruction and against nuclear weapons included in that because they're against all that is holy. So they've had this strand of theological thought in which nuclear weapons have been placed. Now, sometime in the late 1990s, early 2000s, they did develop what we call a hedge capacity. So they developed a capacity to create nuclear weapons. And that is one of the things that the International Atomic Energy Agency has been looking for evidence of for some years now. And it's one of the reasons why they're now considered to be in non-compliance with their obligations, because the agency hasn't been able to put to rest these questions properly.
Is that because they didn't allow the agency to properly inspect what they've been doing?
Yes, they did discover some things, machined metal, things like that, and the explanations have not been forthcoming and have not satisfied the agency.
So at this point, in a sense, they're in a bit of trouble because people think they're developing a weapon and they're not actually doing the things that they need to do to reassure people that they're not.
Yes. So in 2003, the US intelligence agencies, I think along with many others, made a statement that they thought that Iran had stopped its weapons program. And then we had the Iran nuclear deal in 2015, the JCPOA, as it's called, an agreement that was put together by the European Union, Russia, the United States, and Iran. And the UN was in there, there were a whole load of sort of supporting cast. And what it did was it essentially constrained Iran's capability with a lot more inspections. The problem with it was very effective, but it did have a time limit. And that was what really the Republican Party and the Israelis did not like. So it was just a delaying tactic, they thought. The first Trump administration, President Trump decided to pull out of that agreement. And since then, of course, the Europeans, the International Atomic Agency, and Russia have been trying to keep Iran in the deal as best they could, but it's very difficult when the United States have pulled out.
Now, how close does the expert community believe that Iran has ever come to being able to develop a nuclear weapon, having the capacity for one?
So in the early 2000s, they didn't have the material. So they didn't have the enriched uranium they would have needed. They were developing a way of weaponizing, machining the metal in the right way, being able to deliver it, having fusing capability, that kind of thing. And then that stopped, but they started to go ahead with some enrichment, but quite low enrichment. Low enrichment is defined as being below 20% uranium-235, because that's the isotope, the type of uranium that you need for a bomb. Most reactors will require between 3 and 5% of uranium-235 enrichment. Now, for a bomb, you need over 90%. But the thing is about enrichment, the way it's done with centrifuges, is that you can enrich to 20%. It takes quite a long time. But once you go above 20%, it becomes much quicker. It's essentially, you're just building on what you've already enriched. So it's like a hockey stick curve. So Iran, in the last few months, has been able to enrich quite rapidly. And the agency says that it's got over 400 kilograms at 60%. And 60% is very close to 90%. It may not sound it, but it is in terms of the practical reality of it. So if they were to continue enriching, they would have enough material quite quickly for quite a few warheads.
So they'd have had the material for quite a few warheads, and we think that they would have had the capacity to deliver them in some form or another.
They're probably still working on that. So this is a big debate. The US intelligence agencies recently came out saying they don't think that they have progressed on that front. But I think, from what I understand from Israel, that the Israeli intelligence agencies disagree. And I think that within the scientific community and those who follow these things very closely, there's disagreement on that. So it's an unknown. If they are able to enrich quickly to 90%, and if they have been developing a new hedge program, which, you know, so you sit on the hedge, you sit on the fence, but you develop the capacity, then they could do it within a matter of, I don't know, 6 to 12 months. I'm pulling that number out of the air, but, you know, quite quickly. If, however, they have really ditched their weaponization program, then it would take them a lot longer.
Looking at the claims about the Israeli and American attacks on Iran's nuclear capacity, do we have any idea how much of that capacity has been lost?
No. And indeed, a number of experts, including myself, would be very surprised, given the amount of time they had from the beginning of the Israeli bombing to President Trump saying, well, I'm going to give it 2 weeks, to then the US bombing. I'd be extremely surprised if Iran hadn't moved out all of that 60% material, or at least most of it. They wouldn't be able to do much about the centrifuges, as they're very big, they're in big halls, etc. And I would imagine whatever they might have done to dampen the bunker buster explosions, that they're very sensitive machines, so they probably are malfunctioning.
Patricia Lewis. And before we carry on, just a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, which includes the one about ransomware attacks and the one which looks at rare earths, what they are and why everyone wants them.
What happens when a mandate becomes a breakthrough? I'm Nishita Henry, special host of Resilient Edge, a business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte. I sat down with two leaders who are redefining what enterprise transformation looks like. Jerry Hoberman from Deloitte and Sarah Oligood from AWS took me behind the scenes on how manufacturing, government, and global enterprises are evolving through major systems change.
What excites me is when we have these breakthrough moments, that this stuff doesn't happen by accident. The triad of AWS, of Deloitte, of SAP, being able to understand the value proposition that people seek, being able to architect that, and then actually to define a roadmap to progressively achieve the goal really is what makes these successful.
Getting your humans to change the way they're interacting with their technology, the way that they're following the processes, or just that they're reinventing altogether and we're going to completely throw something out is very challenging.
Here's what stood out. The 2027 SAP deadline isn't a compliance problem. It's a strategic reset, a chance to rethink how value is created.
If your vision is across a 10-year horizon, your ROI is going to be different than if your vision is across a 1 or 2 year horizon.
So how do you move decades of systems and data without slowing the business down? And how do you simplify operations while preparing for what comes next? From legacy systems to AI-ready infrastructure, the full conversation reveals how Deloitte, AWS, and SAP help organizations reduce risk and unlock continuous innovation. All of that and more on this special episode of Resilient Edge. Find us wherever you listen to podcasts.
We focus on the part of the internet that most people don't know about. It's called the dark web.
Undercover in the furthest corners of the dark web, US special agents are on a mission to locate and rescue children from abuse.
Move in now.
Police!
From the BBC World Service, World of Secrets, the darkest web follows their shocking investigations. Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Back now to Iran. To find out what impact the 12-day war has had on Iran, its regime and its people, I'm joined by Shashank Joshi, defence editor at The Economist, Professor Ali Ansari, founding director of the Institute of Iranian Studies at St Andrews University, and Dr Lina Khatib, who's an associate fellow at the Middle East and North Africa programme at Chatham House. Shashank, if I can start with you. Let's just tackle this argument about how successful the US has been in its bombing of the nuclear sites. One leaked intelligence report said not very, and President Trump is insisting that it has been very. Can we make anything of this?
I think it's clear to me that what America has bombed has been hit very badly. That's not really the question. The question is what hasn't been hit. And first of all, the question of Iran's stockpile of 400 kilograms of highly enriched uranium. That's about enough for 10 bombs if enriched further. We don't know where it is, and we don't know if some of it or how much of it has been buried or destroyed. The Americans suggest they don't know where it is exactly. The Israelis are saying they do. It isn't clear to me, but that's the source of main concern. On top of that, there are also other sites, including at the big complex at Natanz, which is one of a place where Iran has one of its enrichment plants, as well as some others, which have not been hit badly at all. And so those are really the questions. And the intelligence assessments I've seen so far from the CIA, from the Director of National Intelligence, they don't answer those questions. And I'm concerned that the American government is playing up some of its effects in order to placate Donald Trump. And that's very dangerous because it leaves us not really knowing exactly how long it might take Iran to rebuild this program. Donald Trump is saying, I obliterated the program. Defense Intelligence Agency, which is the part of the Pentagon, says, we're not sure you did. Other agencies say, actually, you know, it did massive damage. But in this debate, I'm very concerned the presentation of intelligence is being distorted to suit policy. And that's always a very troubling thing.
Very interesting. Moving away from the nukes for a moment, Shashank, what is Iran's remaining military capacity should hostilities resume?
Well, obviously, it's air force, its ground forces, its air defence systems, these were all pretty much suppressed or destroyed at the very outset of the conflict. So that would apply to any future conflict. I think the real capability we're interested in is Iran's stockpile of ballistic missile launches. Iran had about 2,500 of these at the beginning. From the Israeli sources, we hear that this probably destroyed two-thirds of those, but that still leaves perhaps a reasonable number in the hands of Iran. It has struggled to use them because it gets blown up every time the launchers go above ground. So if you look at the 500 missiles fired by Iran at Israel, only 6% hit built-up areas, which is much, much fewer than predicted. So that suggests Israel suppressed their launching very effectively. But some of them are still there. There are still some missiles. That hasn't gone away. That would still present a problem in any future war.
Natalina Khatib, when we used to talk about the threat of Iran to other people in the region, it was usually expressed in terms of its proxies, the people who either controlled or influenced it in the region. Do you think that now Iran has anyone that they can really call a friend or useful ally in the region?
Iran has no friends. The Iranian regime has backed itself into a corner. It's a self-inflicted isolation due to its strategy that Iran thought would be an expansionist strategy that would guarantee long-term influence for the Iranian regime in the Middle East. And that was very much dependent on these proxy groups. We're here talking about armed militias like Hezbollah, like groups that were fighting in Syria, in Iraq, also in Yemen, and of course Hamas. And now, when it comes to all those proxies, they have either been militarily defeated by Israel or in some cases are prioritizing self-preservation, like in the cases of the Iraq militias. These factions are looking at the unfolding scenario with Iran, Israel, and the United States and thinking to themselves, this is an unwinnable war, so we'd better focus on saving ourselves.
So in other words, what you're saying is they were not as ideologically attached to Iran, maybe, as we assumed they were. They were more pragmatically attached. And right now, the pragmatic militia says to themselves, no, that alliance is not going to work for us.
There has been some ideological alignment, especially in the case of Hezbollah. But at the same time, all of those groups joined forces in a way with Iran, partly for domestic reasons as well. And so, for example, in Lebanon, if Hezbollah decides to join a current conflict between Iran and Israel, this would mean complete political obliteration for Hezbollah inside Lebanon. So Hezbollah needs to try to survive, having incurred significant losses already, and knows that if it were to enter any military conflict like that, that's it. It would have no political presence in Lebanon anymore. So it's, you know, trying to prioritize the little that it has left.
And what about the Houthis?
The Houthis remain relatively able to act. They have, of course, launched missiles on Israel. However, amongst all of those groups, perhaps they are the ones the most driven by domestic considerations.
Right. Ali Ansari, let's now turn to what's happening inside Iran. What, as far as you can tell, is going on in the upper echelons of the regime right now?
I think overall there's a sense of bewilderment and shock. They're obviously going to try and recover their position, both internally but also in terms of their the prestige that I think many of them will have considered they've lost over the last 12 days. They will double down, I think, a little bit on regime ideology. I've been very struck, actually, that rather than play on the sort of nationalism that was very much in the forefront when the bombing was going on, they've now reverted back to the old sort of religious ideology, which suggests to me that they're looking to consolidate their base, that they don't think they can perhaps link in with wider society in the way that they might have done. They've already announced, for instance, that they've arrested 700 Mossad agents, which is quite striking. So you can see, I think, there will be a certain amount of paranoia that has already sort of characterised much of the regime leadership will now be reinforced because of the events of the last 12 days.
What about internal arguments? I mean, I know I'm asking you to almost to speculate about things we can't know about for sure, but what do we hear?
Well, we already hear that there are divisions in the leadership between those who take a much more hardline position, mainly in the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, but some of the more civilian leaders are questioning, really, the entire approach. And I think the real shock to the system was when the United States entered the fray. I mean, that really set them back. They've always felt in their own mind, although I think they'll probably have to reassess this, that they could sustain an Israeli attack. But they never really wanted to get involved with the United States. And I think Trump's decision to involve the United States probably was the single factor that brought them essentially to a ceasefire.
Right. Shashank,
What does intelligence tell us about the intentions of the regime right now? And not least, the Israelis said, we know where Khamenei is and we could get him if we want to. What's going on there?
Well, I think that Khamenei has obviously been lying very low for obvious reasons, given the obliteration of lots of his aides and senior commanders. And I think in authoritarian regimes, when the leader disappears and is presumably quite difficult to contact because communications are viewed as a potential vulnerability, that does create a sense of a vacuum. And I'm not suggesting that the regime is on the edge of suddenly keeling over and rapidly changing, but I think it's probably fair to say that we see different factions jockeying more aggressively in an environment like that. And in particular, what interests me is, on the one hand, the war accelerating what was underway, which is the accumulation of more power by the Revolutionary Guards. But on the other hand, the senior ranks of the Guards have also been badly thinned out through these strikes. And so you also have a new generation of commanders that has been rising up to the top. I don't think we have a brilliant picture of all of this, but at least some of the indications I see suggest that they are much less inclined towards that sort of strategic patience and restraint that you often saw, for example, when Qasem Soleimani was assassinated in 2020. So that sort of internal shift is something I find quite interesting as one of the consequences of this conflict and the damage it has done inside Iran.
Lina Khatib, let's turn now to the question of the Iranian people themselves. 90 million plus, so generalizations are problematic. Do you think there's a significant chance of this becoming a moment of popular unrest, big street demonstrations, big opposition?
Unlikely, because although the Iranian regime has lost a lot of its external influence, domestically it remains very strong because it is able to crush dissent. And this is something that is happening and will be a deterrent for the local population. And also, when populations are ground down by severe economic hardship, they are less likely to rise up. However, having said all that, Ali Khamenei is likely to be the last supreme leader in the full sense of the word. Meaning, even though from the outside it may look like this regime is still in place, from the inside it is being hollowed out, it is weakened, it is losing its pillars of power, and that is a significant shift that will pave the way for a political change further down the line. But we don't know what that timeline will be.
But the political change, as far as you can see, is not going to come from the popular uprising, which is the thing that always in the West we look for. We look for our Tiananmen Square moments and so on.
There's not going to be regime change through a popular uprising in Iran, at least not anytime soon. Under the current circumstances, the more likely scenario is that this regime gets hollowed out, gets increasingly weakened, a bit like the scenario of Bashar al-Assad in Syria in his last days. And this opens up possibilities for some figures from inside the establishment to perhaps take Iran in a different direction later on. This is a much more likely scenario than popular uprising.
Ali Ansari, do you think that we tend to overestimate the capacity for unarmed people to overthrow regimes which are pointing guns at them?
I think we do, but I agree that the regime will not come out of this well. I think the Revolutionary Guard have been badly damaged, actually, in terms of prestige. You have to remember that the country had no civil defence whatsoever, provided no cover for its own population. A lot of the leadership went into hiding, but many people felt that they were abandoned, essentially, in Tehran and other cities, because there were no air raid sirens, there were no shelters, there were no bunkers for ordinary people. So I think there will be a reckoning. I mean, I think people, once the dust settles, people will start to question. I would tend to agree that what will happen is more of a questioning among the leadership, but I think that will open up the space for dissent.
I was going to push on this point a bit, because from the outside, it would appear that if popular uprising is very unlikely, then the most likely avenue for change is some kind of fissure within the regime itself. Some bit of it says we can't carry on like that and has actually the capacity to do something about it. Is there any such fissure? Is there any such alternative power centre. There's clearly a range of individuals, both within, you know, the current system, those who've also been excluded, who had served in previous sort of governments in Iran. But my sense is that the pressure from below will be felt. We sort of tend to romanticise sort of popular uprisings of people chanting in the street and so on and so forth. I think there are many different ways in which dissent can be felt. Even before, you know, we went into this war, there was a fairly major strike of lorry drivers around the country that was hitting the supply chain fairly severely. And I think, you know, if you start to see strikes and you start to see protests in other ways, this will have its effect.
But Lena, who would do this? Where are the alternative potential centres of power? I do recall in past programmes, you have the clerics and the Guardian Council on the one hand, and then you have the Revolutionary Guard. Then you have the conventional government led by a president who most people in this country couldn't name now. And we've heard nearly nothing from since this all began. Where would we look for alternative sources of power and challenge to the regime structure to make that supreme leader, the last supreme leader, in this fashion?
Definitely not the clerics. I think the days of clerical rule in its current form in Iran are numbered. I think it's more likely that figures with a military background are going to rise.
I think you have to look at the other organisations. So the IRGC are but one of the military arms. The army itself could provide certainly individuals who are more nationalistic in their outlook, could sort of rally around the flag to some extent once they see how the country is, you know, continuing to be misgoverned in the way that it is. I mean, we have to remember that the regime may get a bounce from this. I mean, it may get a small bounce. When you're involved in a war, there's a certain sense of an adrenaline rush. But after the high comes the low, and people will go back to seeing that actually they still can't get enough water, they still can't get enough gas, and they still can't get enough electricity. So you're in a situation where you're likely, I think, to get a coalition of individuals that will probably rally around and say, we need a different form of government. But, you know, we'll have to see that how that unfolds. It will take a little bit of time, I suspect.
Shashank Joshi, is there any sense that the Iranian military is capable of providing that challenge? I mean, in the old days, we'd be looking for a military coup here, you know, so they'd take over, say, the old lot are no good, etc. And in 6 months' time or in a year's time, we'll have fresh free elections, and maybe they will and maybe they won't. Do you see any sign of that in Iran?
Well, I think the interesting thing about Iran is obviously that for many years, the regular armed forces, the regular army, was essentially much weaker than the Revolutionary Guard in terms of its underlying strength and influence. This war, in doing such serious damage to the top ranks of the Revolutionary Guard, and not just the top ranks, also many of their sites, lots of their equipment, lots of their buildings, you know, it has weakened the guards, and it may have slightly altered the traditional balance between the regular army, traditionally very weak, and the Revolutionary Guards. And so, as Ali points out, that may open up a little bit of space for the army to provide new figures who maybe have a different outlook. However, I think the challenge is providing organized opposition, the ability to step in, provide security, provide alternative leadership. I think that's in real question because, you know, in all authoritarian governments, not just in Iran, there are deliberately competing power centers. There are deliberately divisions. And that always complicates the process of an orderly transition of power.
Lena Khatib, let's confront one absolute reality, which is the present supreme leader is not a young man anymore. He's 86. There's been a lot of talk, I think, about the succession. And you could see that moment of succession as a crisis moment. And the other thing you could see is that you might end up paradoxically with somebody even more hardline. Can you just take us through that one?
Well, so far, it is not clear who the successor could be. There was talk about his son, Mujtaba, potentially taking over. Now there are reports from Iran, unconfirmed, saying that he's appointed several successors, perhaps having learned from the experience of Hezbollah, where Israel assassinated the secretary general, then his successor and the successor's successor. So to me, this means that there is panic inside the clerical rank in Iran. That alone opens up the possibility of what I'd like to call an elite coup, which is the coalition that Ali has been talking about, which is military figures with other willing individuals from outside the military establishment who are likely to take this moment of succession chaos as an opportunity.
Shashank Joshi, if they do survive, do you think they will maintain a determination, in fact, a redoubled determination, to get a nuclear weapon?
One conclusion you could draw is that the pursuit of a bomb has got them into this mess. But I think much, much more likely is the conclusion that only a working bomb will deter threats to the regime of the kind that have been made in this war. And I think that this is more likely to drive, as it did, by the way, after Israeli strikes against Iraq's nuclear reactor in Osirak in 1981, an accelerated underground program towards a bomb. The difficulty will not be know-how, of which there is a lot inside Iran, but will be acquiring the specialized components and materials that you need, many of which need to be procured on the international marketplace, that will now be scrutinized with additional pressure and force by Western and Israeli intelligence agencies. So yes, I do believe there will be a fresh drive for a bomb underground, but I'm not necessarily convinced Iran will succeed. And if it is detected going down that route, I wouldn't be at all surprised to find that Israel attacks again and that America may attack again.
And that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to Shashank Joshi, Ali Ansari, Nina Khatib and Patricia Lewis. My conclusion? Well, we may have a crumbling regime which still wants nuclear weapons. Interesting. We'll be back at the same time next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Caroline Bailey and Kirstine Knight. The production coordinator was Maria Ogundeli. The sound engineer was James Beard. And the editor is Richard Varden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again very soon.
Hello, I'm Nick Robinson. You might be tired of switching on the news, hearing those pre-rehearsed sound bites, the lines to take from those who shape our lives. When politics is as fragmented, as unpredictable, as fraught as it is now, it can be hard to cut through the noise. That is precisely my aim on Political Thinking, my podcast from BBC Radio 4. I have extended conversations with those who shape our political thinking. I try to get to the heart of what makes these people tick, what lies behind what you're seeing or hearing on the news. That's Political Thinking with me, Nick Robinson. You can listen on BBC Sounds.
We focus on the part of the internet that most people don't know about. It's called the dark web.
Undercover in the furthest corners of the dark web, US special agents are on a mission to locate and rescue children from abuse.
Move in now.
Police!
From the BBC World Service, World of Secrets, The Darkest Web follows their shocking investigations. Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your BBC podcasts.